born February 12, 1914 in Odom, Texas, said to be the first white baby born in this town. Can you remember anything to tell right quick?
Yes, she was born of what later became the Playboy Club.
Yeah, upstairs over Bell's store. I remember that.
Yeah, Bell was an old saddler.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the little footprints
in front of Bell's store in the cement.
Yeah.
Where they put your baby footprints.
Were they?
Yeah. I seen them once, then they covered them up later, but I seen them years ago.
And as I was saying about the prickly pears, they had would gather a tub of prickly pears and bring them in the cow lot. And take them out of one tub, burn the stickers off over a fire, and put them in another tub. And I remember backing around and falling in one of the tubs, but luckily I just got burnt. It was the ones that had been de-stickered.
They held them over the fire of the pitchfork.
Yeah, that's when I was 7 years old. I remember that.
Yeah, and when they started bringing them prickly pears in, well, here come the cows, just yelling behind them, following them.
Granny, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, my name is Iris Gregory, born June the 9th, 1916 in Odom, Texas.
You're going to say your maiden name.
My maiden name was Iris Tedford. And I had something else on mine, but I forgot it. Oh, just as remember Aunt Tom and them when they moved to Senton. They had the only dipping vat in town, and everybody brought their cattle out there to dip them for ticks.
Right, and they had was a sulfur water. Their well was sulfur water, and people would come for miles and haul that sulfur water.
Yeah.
Thought it was healthy.
Yeah.
And it didn't smell healthy, I can tell you that.
No, but we got used to drinking it and bathing in it and smelling like it, so we got to where we didn't mind it.
Yeah, and they tell them about this old maid that school teacher came from up north and got her a small ranch and put two big cisterns end to end and lived in them until she could get her a house built.
Yeah.
And she drove two big Brahma bulls to a wagon. And she would stop at the side of the road and let these bulls service a cow for a fee. Unhitch either bull and hold him while he tended to the job. Now, yeah. That was a fact.
Yeah, and she used to come out to Aunt Tom's and get loads of sulfur water to take back to her cisterns to where she lived.
What time was this?
That would be in about 1919 or 20.
Yeah.
One or the other.
Mm-hmm. And I just don't hardly remember that 1919 storm in Odom. Now, you remember a little more about it, don't you?
Yeah, I remember them tying the windmill to trees with cables to keep it from blowing over, and when it blowed over, it pulled up a tree and tore part of the porch off.
Mm-hmm.
It also tore up all the outbuildings, everything but the house, and it slid the house on the blocks a few inches.
Mm-hmm. And that was the one where Dad and Grandpa and all of them helped for so many days to go over there and help them.
What's your grandfather's name? Or do you remember?
Joe Ford.
Joe Ford. And my dad's name was John Tedford. And John Granville Tedford, he used the name Granville. But they went, and my uncle
Wayman Ford,
they spent days going out where the tidal wave washed Lower Corpus inland, helping pick bodies out of the wreckage and taking them down to the depot. And I think they took them down there and stacked them on flat cars till they could identify them. They were covered with oil and all that stuff. And for years, they was where the water come in and stopped, they was just a high as a house in places, stack of broken lumber and furniture and stuff where it washed in, and at first there was bodies mixed with it till they picked them out. I remember them coming home and their hands would be shriveled up from the water and they'd have oil all over them. They'd come home and eat and sleep 2 or 3 hours and then go back to work some more. And I guess all of the men in Odom worked at that for days. and surrounding towns.
Yeah, that. Do you remember any, how bad it struck Oldham? Did it just wipe it out?
No.
No, it didn't.
It
damaged Oldham quite a bit, was all, but all of the debris and such from Corpus was in a line about 3 miles from Oldham.
And it was caused.
See, it washed it clean across the bay, and that's where it all stuck in a drift, right
and
near Oldham.
It wasn't the winds that done so much destruction. There was a tidal wave come across Lower Corpus.
That's what Lower Corpus was so bad.
See, Upper Corpus wasn't destroyed so bad. You know how it split into two levels?
They call it Corpus Under the Hill, I think.
Yeah.
Down along the low. Mm-hmm.
Of course, I have no idea how many people was killed. I've never read or heard. I doubt if they have an accurate count.
I doubt that.
How about the flood you're talking about in
Tom's time? Oh, that was, let's see, that must have been about 1928, I think, in Senton, when I was visiting my uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Wayman Ford, and this flood come in. They lived 3 miles west of Senton on Chilipine Creek. And when the creek got out of its banks, the house is about a block up from the creek. We waited and put cattle and hogs and things up on the higher pasture ground. And when the water started coming over the porch and into the house, my aunt and a visiting aunt couldn't swim. So we took them over to a fence that led about a mile up, a barbed wire fence, past a two-story house belonging to some people named Wright. And we put them on the opposite, the water was swift, and we put them on the opposite side of the fence where they couldn't wash away, and they followed this fence and held on to it up to this two-story house. And then my uncle and I stayed there and took beehives to save a few and set them on the back porch table. And they had a water shelf built between the post of the back porch for the wash pan and water bucket. And we set two hives up there, and we put about 30 chickens in the attic and a dog with four pups in the attic. And by then, the water was coming in the house, and we had to leave. And up in the field, we caught a horse, one of his horses, and got on the horse. He had a rope with him, and we got on the horse and rode the horse up to this house, but there's two deep flooded gullies that he had to get off, and the horse had to swim, and my uncle swam, and I stayed on the horse. And he got me up to this house. And on the way, we passed a little house with a woman and two small children, one about two and one less than that, setting up on a table on the front porch. And when he got to the house and let me off, he got another man with a horse and went back and got her and the two children and brought them up there. And by...
Do you know who they were?
No, I have no idea who they were. But a little after dark, there was four upstairs rooms in this house, and there was about 25 people there. And the water kept coming up until the next day. A girl about 12, the same age as I, and myself, the girl's last name was Littleton, I don't remember her first name. She was a native of Senton. We went downstairs to look for something to eat, and the water was so deep on the first floor of the house, we had to swim to the kitchen. And all we could find was, above water, was 5 pounds of raisins and a cloth sack that we took back upstairs, and of course the little children ate them. And the next, that evening sometime, there was a motorboat come out from town with two men in it and asked could they help, and they took my uncle, Wayman Ford, back to town in the motorboat, and he says they went right down Main Street, and there was a store there known as McWhirter's Store. And he had opened these doors, and there was water deep enough in the store that they run the boat in the store and helped themselves to whatever canned goods they wanted and just signed a bill that they'd pay him later. how much it was, and everybody was doing that. He'd opened the store for that purpose, and they loaded the boat with canned food and brought it back out for us to eat. And we stayed there two nights, and the third day the water went down. And we went back to the house in a wagon, and of course the water had been about 4 feet in my uncle's house. Furniture had come unglued and come apart, and everything was scattered and mud all over everything. It took us days to clean up what was left, and some of it we just had to throw out.
You remember about those animals you saw?
Yeah, I remember one. I went out to the back gate and water about waist deep, and it was pretty swift, and a coon come swimming by. They usually pretty vicious, but he was swimming with that tide, and I just reached out like a kid will and grabbed him by the tail, and I held him for 5 minutes, and he never looked around. He just kept swimming, and I finally turned him loose, and he just went right on down with the water. But he never looked around to see that he was stopped or anything.
Now, you said something about those people left their homes open. These people were, you know, where y'all stayed.
Oh, the two-story house where we stayed, Mrs. Wright and her son had left and went somewhere else, so we broke in a window to get in to stay there, which in those days was customary and expected. Wasn't nothing wrong about it. And that's the way people expected you to do and lived in them days.
What about the Christmas y'all had the train set, you had to go and get the fuel for the train for Santa Claus and that.
What? Callum, wasn't it?
Callum. Store.
Yeah, well, you talking about that. You
I don't remember that.
Don't you remember your little cannon that Uncle Wayne and Dad used all the carbide and had to go wake Mr. Callum up before we got up at 5 o'clock and go down to the store and get some more carbide?
Oh, yeah, I remember that little cannon, yeah. You could, had a little bitty cup on the back part and a wheel and flint like cigarette lighter. You get the little cup full of powdered carbide, and the inside had a little chamber with water in it. When you pushed it in and locked it in place, it dumped that carbide in that chamber of water and made a gas, and then you just hit your little spark, and boy, she would make a noise like a shotgun.
Yeah.
Of course, after I learned to put clay balls in it and shoot at people with it, they took it away from me.
How'd it come about that Christmas?
Oh, they bought these things, and in them days, well, we didn't prepare for Christmas ahead. They put the kids to bed, and then they put up the tree and got the toys out, and they was just there Christmas morning. So they put my brother and I to bed, and then my dad and my uncle spent all night playing with this cannon, and we heard it. And houses in them days had wallpaper and canvas and kind of cracks, so we managed to get us a hairpin and tear the wallpaper and the canvas clear through where we could watch through a peephole and see what they was doing. About 3 o'clock in the morning, they run out of carbide. So they had to go down to Mr. Kellum to open his hardware store and get him some more carbide before they woke us kids up. But we'd been awake all night watching them through the peephole. Because you could hear the cannon shooting a block away. I don't remember Mr. Kellum's first name. He just run Kellum's hardware store.
Now, I remember must have been about 1926 when Aunt Tom got Mustang grapes every year and made grape juice and grape jelly. And I know we slipped out two jars of her grape juice, or two bottles, opened them up and put a certain amount of sugar in them and hid them up in a hollow tree. One of them finally exploded, and the other one was pretty good drinking. The only thing, it got opened up and full of bugs. Pretty good taste.
Oh, yes, you remember right as you turned down to about a block from the house at Uncle Wayman's and Aunt Tom's, Wayman and Tom Ford, there was a oak tree, and right at the side of this oak tree was the trunk of a grapevine. It was on Chilipine Creek. And this grapevine would measure about, what's straight through?
Diameter.
And about 13 or 14 inches in diameter. Its trunk was
at
as big as...
At least that.
It was as big as the tree trunk. The biggest grapevine I have ever seen, or I've heard other people say they seen.
Was it Mustang?
It was a Mustang grape. And there was a grove of oak trees, about 12 or 14 big oak trees along the creek right there, and it covered every one of them. And it was full of grapes every year. Some of the vines didn't have grapes, but that one was always full. And I suppose I've never seen another grapevine even a third as big as that. But when they got oil down in that country and they didn't have the laws to keep the salt water out of the creeks, it killed all the trees along the creeks and the grapevine. And of course, there's no part of it left. There's no oak trees along the creek or nothing. The creek's just washed out wider and wider and wider and wider and got nothing but a little trickle of salt water in it.
That is along that vine. You remember we had that little Jenny come along outside of kicking you, biting you, and stepping on your feet. Well, she's pretty good, Jenny.
Yeah.
I know we was riding the trail there, that same grapevine, there was some smaller vines from it hanging looped down over the trail, and we come a running along there, both of us on that little Jenny, and of course I was in front and seen the grapevine and duck, and she run her head in it and just left her hanging. I had to go back and get her. Hanging the kicking.
Hanging by my chin. Weren't funny to me. No, it sure worked.
And I'd hook that old Jenny up and go over in the field, neighbor's field. He had watermelons and cantaloupes at all.
Do you remember his name?
Ashby.
Ashby. And
mm-hmm.
They all, in that country, get hot and such, and they all got ripe at one time. And I'd go over there with a big homemade sled hitched to that Jenny and get sled loads of them and bring them and throw them in the hog pen, good watermelons. Bust them and eat the heart out of a few of them, throw the rest mm-hmm. in and feed the hogs.
Yeah, then one year they had tomatoes.
Now what year was that, whenever you busted the watermelon?
That would be about 1924 or 5. It was early.
Mm-hmm. And just about that time we used that sled to go over to another farmer's. I don't remember their names. And get tomatoes. We'd fill this box on it with tomatoes and bring them home mm-hmm. to can and to feed the hogs.
That was Cox. His name was Cox. Yeah, and he was the one that later on lost his mind and dreamed that he'd see streets of gold. He went crazy on religion. He'd dream he seen streets of gold and stuff, and he'd know right where they was at, in this pasture, in that pasture, and he'd go and dig holes. It was all, I'd say, 3 to 4 feet long and probably 2 feet wide. He'd just go straight down with those holes going. He knew where it was at that time till he'd hit water. It'd run him out of the hole eventually after he went down 30 feet maybe. I know I've plumb down a lot of them holes. He'd put just little places in each side and you could get that away and go down in it.
I'd forgot about him till you mentioned it.
Yeah, yeah. The ranchers finally and farmers finally got after him because his holes were dangerous in their pastures.
Mm.
He got to where he'd still dig them, but he'd cover them good. I know Uncle Wayman one time butchered, he sold 3 steers to the butcher there in Senton. I don't remember his name. Anyway, he come out and butchered them on the place. He gave me 50 cents to take all the entrails and such in an old two-wheel cart and push them to one of Cox's gold holes and take the top off and dump them in it. I remember that. Cox say, I swear I don't see how that full-grown animal fell in that hole and spoiled before I found it.
Yeah, I forgot.
Well, I'll tell you another one. You remember Uncle Wayne? He
He wanted to build him a new outhouse, and he wanted a good deep pit, and he needed a shed to put feed in anyway, so he met Mr. Cox and got to thinking. He told him right Miss Terrace like he'd had a dream. Well, yeah, what, Ford? Well, he said, I dreamed I saw them streets of gold you're talking about. Says I saw them just as plain, and says I saw some reference. Now, what? Oh, that's... He says, it was that, you know, that crooked oak tree out just back of my yard. Yeah, yeah. He said, it was right at the side of that. Well, Ford, can I dig there? Yeah, says, go ahead and dig. So Cox, he dug him a hole clean down the water looking for gold, and then when he didn't find it, why, of course, and went on his way, Uncle Wayman went and built his outhouse and his shed over the hole. It saved him some labor there.
Yeah, I forgot that too.
You still haven't told about the old maid.
Yeah, I told about the old maid. Yeah. Her two bulls that she drove to the wagon.
I wished I could remember her name, but I just can't. I know she was a school teacher.
Yeah, she was well educated. Well-educated woman.
From somewhere north. We never knew where. She's kind of...
She come down here. Yeah, she come down here for her health. She had tuberculosis. That's why, how come her to come to that country?
I was so little, I just faintly remember her. I do remember the first car that we got. It was a...
1914 Model T.
Yes. And my dad went down and bought it. He had never drove a car. And there was a little old rutted road to Carpus. That
it was all dirt.
All dirt road to Carpus. Mm-hmm.
This was in about 1919.
Yeah. And he got in there, and the guy showed him how to drive it, and he drove to Carpus, and my mother drove back. Neither one of them probably never rode in a car before.
Well, they didn't meet another car either way, so no. It didn't take much driving.
No, they didn't meet any. They managed to make the trip. And I remember a little about the car, and I remember their treatment for snake bite, because I was going with him to get the cows on the road from Senton to Odom, and a snake bit me right in the middle of the road. He's laying there.
About what year?
I was 1923. I was 22. I was.
Yeah, we come to Houston 23.
We did. Well, it was 22. He was laying in the middle of the road, and a car had run over him, and I run past him without seeing him, and so he bit me on the leg, and when I felt it, I was afraid, and I run back to Dad, and when I run back past him, he bit me again on the same leg.
He was a ground rattler.
He was a ground rattler. And, of course, the treatment then for a snake bite was to put a tight...
I think the proper name's pygmy rattler.
Yeah. Was to put a tight tourniquet and wash it with coal oil. So he grabbed me up and run to a neighbor's house that they weren't home, but everyone had a coal oil can sitting on the back porch, and he washed my leg with coal oil and grabbed a towel hanging out there and wet it in coal oil and wrapped it around my leg and took me to town to the doctor.
Dr. Reinhardt.
Yeah. Dr. Reinhardt, the town doctor, and he cut it open and put something on it. Anyway, it didn't bother me a great deal. I got over it in a few days. But that was about the only treatment for snake bite then, was to wash it in coal oil, I guess, the accepted treatment. And I don't see where it done any good, but he never loosened the tourniquet either. He carried me around till he got me to the doctor's house, and he took it off.
What about that picnic y'all had over to Mantis Lake that time?
Mathis, Corpus Christi Lake, that was when they were building the dam.
Yeah, Lake Corpus Christi.
Yeah, it was, when did they build that dam? Was it 28?
I don't remember.
Somewhere around 1928, the dam was not completed. We walked out on
what they had of it and picnicked there. We just mainly went over to see the construction and what they were doing. It was a long time before the dam was completed, and picnicked there.
And that's a small dam, too. It's under the big lake now. They built a much bigger dam.
Oh, they have?
Yeah, that little one is many feet under the lake.
Well, it was built just, as well as I remember, it was built of crushed up granite, because I picked up two or three pieces of granite rock, big as an egg, that looked like that they had just filled it in with that old, wide enough you could have drove a car over it. We didn't try it. It's too loose and dangerous, but it looks like they just crushed that stuff up and put it there. Maybe they concreted the sides later. I don't know. Maybe that was just the filling.
Was it pretty good fishing?
Well, it wasn't then because there wasn't no water in it. We didn't go back to fish thereafter.
It was a New Asis River. It had been awful good catfishing river. Always
yeah.
Has been.
It was good catfishing weather and our river, and I suppose it still is for that matter.
Still is.
I know about once a year my Uncle Wayman and a couple of his friends, I don't remember their names, would take a weekend trip down the New Asis River to kill squirrels, and sometimes he'd bring back, I don't know how many squirrels, just gobs of them. I ain't had can them. There's no other way to keep them in them days. No freezers or anything. So she would can them.
You know how they canned them? What type of ingredients are in?
Well, she just more or less cooked them in a boiling canner. They didn't have pressure canners. In glass jars. Put them in the jars and with water and seasoning and usually just salt and pepper. And just boil them in that canner until they was done and seal them. And then when she took them out, sometimes she'd make dumplings with them or however she wanted to cook them.
Mm-hmm.
From the cans, that's the only way they had of preserving meat.
They had a crock, was I guess 10 gallon on them big crocks that he took with him. I know he brought that back with packed as many clean dressed squirrels as he could pack in that crock, put a lid on
it. 10-gallon crock in 2 days'
time.
They
were packed in there, just as many as they could pack in.
Is that cloth bag or what?
No, it's a crock.
Stone
crock.
Yeah, stoneware, about 10 gallons.
Like the old churns used to be. I don't know if you've seen old Asher churn or not.
No.
You missed something. You ought to have had the churn with one.
Tell about that.
Yeah.
Well, it was just a crock, only it was smaller at the top than the bottom and had a wooden top that fit with a hole in it. And through this hole went a stick like a broomstick with a cross on the bottom of it.
2 1x2s put in shape a cross on the bottom, and you churned up and down, churned up and down with it.
Yeah, I've
got into work, you'd sweat.
Yeah, I sat on the back porch many a time and churned that old churn just up and down till your butter made, and then when your butter made, well, you poured a little cold water in there to kind of gather the butter on top and skimmed it off, and then you had to work it in a bowl with a spoon and keep pouring your milk out till you got all the milk worked out of it and salted a little and put it in a butter mold and mold it into about a pound brick with
picture of a snake on top of it.
Is that what it had?
That's what it had on it.
I knew the mold
yes,
had a picture
sir.
That made a print, but I didn't remember what
it
was. Made
a fancy snake on top of it with a bush or something. I don't remember what.
Yeah.
Gene, we ain't getting no part of
this. We get
to listen to y'all. We're just getting
glad. Well, y'all can ask questions.
I can't think of nothing else now.
Let me go ahead and turn the tape over.
And when I was 5, and we came on the train, of course, when we got close to Houston, I remember my mother showing me some pine trees. And I got all disturbed because I couldn't see the pineapples on them. That's about the main thing I remember about that trip was my first sight of pine trees with no pineapples. Say something, brother dear.
I ain't talking.
What about whenever y'all went, your father went shrimping and then you would go out to Corpus? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
Y'all come back and...
Went to Ingleside, and you remember that?
9 mile point at Ingleside, but they'd go and seine their own shrimp. A lot of big eating shrimp was just a menace seine.
About when was that?
That was 1920. Uh-huh. Weighed out with just big cane poles and then catch loads of fish.
About how long was the seine?
20 foot.
20 foot.
About a 20 foot minnow.
Sometimes they'd get a number two wash tub half full of jumbo shrimp. That we'd build a campfire and we'd eat supper. Usually they'd have a, get a little bait and just walk out and catch fish enough for supper. And we'd eat supper and then we'd sit around the campfire and drink coffee until we heard the shrimp come in this shallow bay. And it was kind of grassy bottomed.
And you could hear them shrimp. Yeah. They'd come so many in there.
Sound like a horse running through
you
the water.
You hear them in the water. Yeah. Once this fish are running at them, I guess something anyway, they scoot through the shrimp would jump through the water. You could hear them when they come in, know they're there.
And they'd go out and seine up half a tub full, put some in their live boxes and to fish with alive, and some of them just dump in a tub for dead bait. We'd never heard of eating shrimp then. Didn't think this fit to eat. Then they would go floundering and get maybe 25 or 30 nice flounders, bring them in. Then the next morning they'd wade out for serious fishing with cane poles to catch trout and redfish. And I don't know what we'd done with all the fish that we didn't eat because we didn't have any way of keeping them.
Did they use a regular cane pole or throat
regular
line?
Cane pole,
regular,
yeah.
Cane pole, and big, long, 16, 18 foot ones, heavy ones.
Rod and reel,
yeah. Anybody had a rod and reel even later than that was a smart aleck.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be around him.
No, you're supposed to fish the cane pole.
Anybody in them days had a rod and reel or an outboard motor either. You smart aleck.
And, of course, sometimes us kids wade out and fish a little, but we really like to spend our time in the sand and the bushes hunting centipedes and scorpions and things like that that we got whipped for playing with.
Various types of wildlife.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I guess we didn't look for them.
I guess we didn't pay any attention to them. There's so many of them. Now, that big shell over there, conch shell comes from somewhere around there after a storm, but I don't know when or where. At least I know I'm 55 and I've seen it all my life, so far back as I can remember, so it's been a long time. But us kids, we didn't look for anything as safe as shells. We looked for snakes and centipedes and scorpions and things of that sort, ant beds and road runners or just anything we could tangle with and get whipped over.
Always caught and played with garter snakes, and nobody knows now how many of them were coral snakes instead. We didn't know the difference.
No, we'd never heard of a coral snake. We thought everything with them around colorful stripes was a garter snake and harmless. And so we'd catch them and play with them and then skin them to make us belts out of. We never made the belts, but we've grabbed many a live coral snake, I guess, and skinned him. But luckily, we didn't get bit.
What y'all mainly eat at home? Just meat and potatoes?
Oh, chicken, beans, greens. Most everyone had a garden. Even in town, they had their garden with tomatoes and greens and green beans and peppers and all kind of vegetables. And of course in South Texas it's always been warm enough in the winter you could have turnips or you could have something growing almost the year round. turnips and cabbage. And
everybody had chickens.
Uh-huh. Everybody had their own eggs and chickens. And even when we lived downtown, one block from the schoolhouse, in downtown Senton, we had our milk cow and our chickens. Everybody had their milk cow. And I don't remember. I guess there was just enough vacant property for them to graze on. Or
so that's where we was feeding them the prickly pears that I sat down in.
Oh.
Did you ever go to school down there, Joe?
I went my first year at Senton Elementary School.
I didn't
that
go
was
to school.
In 1922.
What did you think of school, or you don't remember? Do you remember anything?
About school?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot. About like any school.
No, I know they did have, at that time, they had different schools for the Mexican population. They didn't go to school with the Caucasians. Because where we lived was one block from what they call the Mexican school. Now they have rebuilt it into a big, nice high school on that location. And of course, the house we lived in was tore down. But we lived in Odom, I guess, until, oh, I think I was about 3 when we moved to Senton. Oh, yeah, something else I remember. When we would stay with Aunt Tom when we were real young, in 1921, they had a family of Mexicans, a man and his wife. Did they have any children?
I don't think they did.
That lived on their farm and helped farm. And I remember whenever we got stung by a red ant or a bee or a wasp, that this woman would hunt a prickly pear and take one of the little new leaves if they had them. If they didn't, just one of the old ones, and cut it down the middle and cut thorns off and get a little piece of that pulpy juice and put on it to stop the sting, and it stopped the sting too. She also made poultices to draw the poison out of boils with this juice, I think
with
now. Prickly pear juice. Now they use aloe vera, but she used prickly pear juice for the same purposes, even on burns or anything. Just cut that leaf open and smear that old sticky juice on you. Mm-hmm. And I think they only lived there 1 year, and I don't remember anything else about them, but I do remember her going out getting prickly pears to put on me when red ants had stung me and bees. So I suppose it was one of the widely used medicines by country people for colds, coughs, croups. They gave us coal oil on a spoonful of sugar. They'd drop coal oil on it. Not kerosene made out of petroleum, but coal oil made out of coal. And poke it down us to tree. That was the main treatment for croup or a bad, bad cough or cold or anything. Any kind of a cut or anything like that, of course, you treated with turpentine. Outside of that, I don't remember a lot of medications. In the spring, they fed us sulfur.
Yeah, they used cloverine salve on us, and we even sold it lots of times.
Yeah, that's right. Cloverine
salve. Get religious pictures for a prize after you sold so much of it.
Yeah, it was 25 cents a little flat can, like a can of shoe polish.
Yeah, cloverine salve, and it sure smells sweet. I think it's just pure Vaseline with a little perfume in it.
I think so. But everybody used it, and had it.
Yeah, it was one of the best.
Yeah, you just had to have it.
Did it work?
I guess it did. Nobody died.
I never heard of it killing anybody, so I guess it done as much good as Vaseline on sores and things. Yeah, I think that you got a dozen boxes and a dozen pictures, about 10 by 12, usually religious pictures.
Yeah.
And you give one with each box sold for 25 cents, and for your dozen boxes you made about 50 cents profit, which was a very good profit. Most all kids sold so Clovereen Salve then instead of paper routes, because they only had a weekly paper. And they put that in your post office box. They didn't deliver it.
About what year was that whenever you sold the Clovereen
Salve? Anywhere from 1919 to after we come to Houston, we sold some in 1924 even.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Years we were Clovereen salesmen.
Mm-hmm. Of course, anything worse than that, you used Watkins liniment if it was a sprain or something, or sometimes you used that to drink for a cough too. Drink the liniment. And if you didn't have coal oil handy, well, drink the liniment. Of course, everyone
drank coal oil?
A little of it, yeah.
Yeah.
You put a little on a spoon of sugar and a few drops. You didn't drink it. A few drops on a spoon of sugar or a few drops of turpentine either. Supposed
yeah.
to cure anything.
Sure. And really, I guess it must have done some help, but it was made out of coal oil. It wasn't made out of petroleum like kerosene is. And when kerosene come on the market, it was such a habit of using coal oil internally that they was just lots of kids drank kerosene and got sick, or some of them died from it. And some people, even not knowing the difference, give kerosene to kids or to grown-ups with coughs and bad colds, because they didn't realize that the kerosene was poisonous and toxic, and the coal oil wasn't. Because they used coal tar base, you know, for a lot of cosmetics and medicines and things. It's a more or less safe product. But that was one of our main medicines, as well as I remember, was sulfur and cream of tartar in the spring, Clovereen Salve, turpentine, and coal oil. And nothing like that wasn't a broken bone or something like that, you didn't go to a doctor with it. You just treated it with them things at home. You only went to a doctor with very, very serious ailments.
A lot of times you live in spite of it instead of because of it.
Yeah. And, of course, all the houses then, even where we lived in downtown Senton, you had no bath or anything like that. You had an outside pump. And most of the houses was built with a back porch with a shelves built between the post, where you kept a wash pan and a bucket of water and a towel hanging to wash your hands. And that's where they'd strain their milk after milking before taking it in. And you kept your can of coal oil sitting out there for used coal oil to cook with. It was on the back porch, so there was just a lot of back porch living then that now there's no use for, of course. In fact, as I remember, most houses then was built like a box. They was just 4 rooms or 6 rooms or 8 rooms or whatever it was, just put together like a box, all the same size. And some was used for a parlor, and some for bedrooms, and some for kitchen, but there was no built-in cabinets in your kitchen or no built-in closets in your bedrooms. You had wardrobes that you set up against the wall to keep your clothes in. In the kitchen, you had old kitchen cabinets that was built to set against the wall, all built in one unit, you know, that you bought and set them against the wall. It had flour bins and sugar bins and things built in them that tipped out, and a little workspace. Then you had a coal oil stove, usually, or a wood stove. And as far as I know, most of the houses I remember had a fair-sized kitchen with a table in it and done most of your eating in the kitchen. Usually had a shelf space built along the wall with where you kept your dish pan and your water bucket with water and everything to wash your dishes and do your cooking, wash your vegetables and things like that. And of course some people that was a little better off had pumps put in the house where they could just pump their water, had them drilled under the house and up through where they could just have a hand pump right there on the shelf in the kitchen. But still you had to throw your water outside. Usually they throwed it out in the flowers or garden or something like that, dishwater, and water you washed your hands in, cleans your vegetables and things.
Ain't nothing to take with.
I was trying to think of something about anything I know about the King Ranch is strictly hearsay back in them days, so that wouldn't be first-hand experience or knowledge. So, maybe you could have a sample ball.
Okay. What about her?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Repeat that story.
I'll let it go now. I'll do it afterwards.
And maybe someone would play a song on a piano and they'd hear it. Well, the only way they could take it to where they could play it would be to learn the music and the words from them. Now, some people in big cities could buy sheet music for the piano or organ, but otherwise they just had to learn songs one from another, see, and learn the words that way.
And then they'd take, and somebody'd write a new song down, and then everybody'd copy it.
Yeah, and they'd have to all learn the tune and know the tune and just copy the words down, because nobody could read music much then, just the musicians. So my aunt, see, she would, her name was Tommy Ford, she'd hear these songs and learn the tune, and then she'd copy them down in this composition book so she'd remember the words. And then anybody that liked them or heard her sing them, well, she would teach them the tune, and they'd copy the words down, and it just passed from one person to another.
No,
she didn't play an instrument. She just sung.
Oh, she
did. Uh-huh. Uncle Wayman played a fiddle, because everybody played fiddle then, men. I never knew of a woman fiddler, but I guess there were some, but they nearly all played fiddles. And she sang all the time, and my mother and my grandmother and everybody, and that's the way they learned these songs, would be to, if somebody went somewhere and heard a new song, well, they had to learn the tune and then copy it down and bring it back home and teach it to everybody, see. And that's why they kept the words of them like that. And they had to know the tunes in their head. And I expect I know the tunes of two-thirds of those songs, except I don't have no voice to carry them with. That's my problem. But she used to sing them to me to where I'd know the tunes to most of them. I forgot a lot of the words, but I'd have to look them up in that book. But that's how the book come about. And these different towns and dates she would be visiting, and that's where she'd hear the song and learn it and write it down, is why she put the date in that city usually. And then two of them in there was written by my mother that she heard someplace and come got this book and wrote it down, because then you couldn't run to the Cunner grocer and buy a composition book. You had to find somebody else's and use it if you didn't have one.
Did you say who your mother was?
No, she was Edwina Ford. And she wrote two of the songs, and I think one of them was dated 1910 or 12, something like that, in Tulanga, which is West Texas, an old Quicksilver mine where she lived. That song about Navajo, that's where a Navajo girl had a Negro boyfriend. I don't know if you read the song or not.
Yeah, Daddy read it.
Yeah. And of course, I don't know now what they think about that in the way things is different, but then, well, this Negro was courting this Navajo girl.
Tell about that zebra
done. I'd have to reread it to tell it, Gene, because I don't remember the words, but I know when I was a kid that everybody knew it. Every kid knew it. And every old fiddler knew it. And every barn dance or get-together, somebody had to sing it or play it. It was just one of the popular cowboy songs. And I thought everybody knew it now. I didn't know you had never heard of it.
No, that was one I had heard, really. I mean, there was some cowboy songs there that I could remember hearing. I had forgotten the name.
I wish I could remember what it was Harley Bryant, her dad.
First married, he went to visit my uncle. And I think you heard about that hole the old man dug, and he built an outhouse over it then.
Yeah, I heard that part.
Well, all right. This outhouse, he built it all about 8 feet long and plenty of room, and he'd keep several sacks of feed in there, too. But we went there when we was first married, and she got sick, got a virus or something, and oh, she was sick, and she went out and got in that outhouse.
I spent 3 days.
Yeah, and Uncle Wayman discovered what was going on. He is a devil anyhow, and he had an old sow that was about 3 feet tall, great big old sow, and he just went out there and went to slop that old hog and got his bucket of slop and got him an idea. Come on, Sir Reed, old gentle sow. Took that bucket of slop and got that old sow to follow him. He went there and pulled that door open and just set that bucket way in there, and in went that sow with her, and he just shut the door and went on back in the house.
Yeah, but run that hog when he said
he did.
Well, what'd you do then, Louise? I ain't gonna.
He was in the right
place. I'm not saying. But why?
This interview of Joe Tedford and Mrs. Iris Gregory of South Texas History was made on April the 3rd, 1972.